welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Jessica with Syosset Library Turn the Page podcast, and we have an awesome guest today who wrote an extremely interesting book about somebody I think everybody should know about. Please introduce yourself and tell us about Martha Gellhorn.
Hi, I'm Janet Somerville. I'm coming to you from Toronto, Ontario, and I wrote a book called Yours for Probably Always, Martha Gellhorn's Letters of Love and War, 1930 to 1949. And I actually came upon Gellhorn by accident. I had been reading a book called What There Is to Say We Have Said, which is a book of the correspondence of the great Eudora Welty and William Maxwell. And I was tweeting about how much I loved this book. And a stranger in Fife, Scotland, wrote to me and said, well, have you read the selected letters of Martha Gellhorn? And at that time, I had not. So I read those letters and I read everything by Gellhorn and about Gellhorn that I could get my hands on and became completely obsessed with her. I started to write a novel and had decided that that novel would begin when she arrived in Paris in 1930. Was the notion of becoming a foreign correspondent. And it traveled with her through the Great Depression when she ended up working for the Federal Emergency Relief Administration for Harry Hopkins under FDR, through the Spanish Civil War in 1937-38 when she was there with Hemingway, and then her time as a war correspondent during World War II. And I was going to end the novel in 1946 in London, where her play, which is called Love Goes to Press, which is about two women war correspondents based on her and Virginia Cowles, another woman war correspondent. And it opened to standing ovations in London. And I was going to have the two of them sort of gobsmacked by these standing ovations heading out into the foggy night. And then I found out that Paula McLean had sold a book called Love and Ruin, which is about Martha and Ernest. And I knew that I couldn't compete with best-selling author Paula McLean. So I was trying to figure out what else I might do. In the meantime, another sort of serendipitous thing happened. I met Adam Hochschild. Now, Adam wrote a book called Spain in Our Hearts. And Spain in Our Hearts is about all of the volunteers who served in the Lincoln Brigade during the Spanish Civil War. And he had access to Martha Gellhorn's restricted papers at Boston University. And so I talked to Adam after the event and said, is there any chance he would be able to put me in touch with Martha Gellhorn's literary executor? And he gave me his card and he said, you know, wait for a couple of weeks till I get back to California, email me and I'll put you in touch. And so he did. And so I wrote to Sandy Matthews, who is Martha's literary executor and her stepson from her marriage to Tom Matthews. And to my great astonishment, and I remain astonished by the trust he put in me, he gave me permission to access her papers at Boston University. Now those papers remain restricted until 25 years after Martha's death, which is 2023. And when I got there, the archivist assigned to me told me that I was maybe among a handful of people that have been granted access. And now I can name you at least three of the other people: Caroline Moorhead, her authorized biographer, Amanda Vale, who wrote The Hotel Florida, and Adam Hochschild. And me, and I was a nobody.
Oh, that's so awesome. I think I'm geeking out just thinking about
it. Yeah, no, it's crazy, right?
The idea of being able to just dig through something like that and to be able to, you know, have your eyes on something so expansive that not everybody, that such a limited amount of people are able to get. And of course, you know, then you look at the list of people. That's,
I know, it's insane. It's insane. Anyway, I will remain grateful for the rest of my life that Sandy Matthews, for whatever reason, trusted in me to serve Martha and her words. And so when I was there at the archives, and I followed, you know, Robert Caro, the great biographer, one of the things he has said over and over again is turn every page. And I did that. I turned every single page in Martha's archives. I was there for sort of a week at a time. And I just went to the archives, you know, from the time they opened in the morning until the time they kicked me out. Monday. Well, I had to, right? Because I was there from Toronto. I needed to make the most of my time. And
listen,
and
I'm not laughing at you.
No, I know.
I would probably be the person they're kicking out too. So
I didn't stop.
That was a commiserative laugh. Like, don't kick.
Yeah, I didn't stop for lunch because, and also, when you're researching that intensely, time just falls away. You know, like. And I was finding things that were so exciting. And the other thing was I kept handwriting Sandy Matthews letters. Each time I went to Boston, I wrote him a letter about the things that I found. And he doesn't even know everything that's in Martha's papers because he hasn't the time to go through all of that himself. He's the custodian of her legacy, right?
Yeah.
So he was happy to hear of the things I was sharing with him, some of the things that made it into the book and some that didn't. And I hope to write a sequel to it that will cover 1950 to 1998. But with COVID, the archives have been closed.
Yeah.
And all of the research has to be done on site because the papers remain restricted. It would be different if, so for example, if I wanted to request material from the JFK library where Ernest's papers are open, Hemingway's papers are open, and any of the correspondence with Martha is accessible, then they could make PDF copies and send them to me, right, electronically. But because the papers are restricted, I can't do that.
Martha's career spans so long.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, you know, up to 1998, I believe I was reading that around, was it 1990, she officially said that she was unable to...
96, actually.
96, okay.
She filed her final piece of journalism around her birthday, which is November 8th in 1996. So she was 88 years old, and she'd gone to Salvador, Brazil, and she wrote about the murdered street children of Salvador, Brazil. Nobody in the world had their eye on the murdered street children, but Martha Gellhorn did. And so she went there with a knapsack on her back and in her running shoes,
mm-hmm.
and wrote about that. And it's an extraordinary piece, but she was frustrated by the process of writing it because she did touch typing on her typewriter because she always used the typewriter,
right,
for the long form journalism pieces. And she couldn't read what came out of the, you know, on the paper. So she had to have somebody read aloud to her and then make corrections that way, which was a very laborious and frustrating process for her. And that's why she gave it up. Not because she was 88, but because she was starting to lose her eyesight. And she was too frustrated.
I think one of the things that I read, like a quote, I'm not sure if this was your quote specifically, but it really struck me was that Martha always looked while others looked away.
That's right. She did. And that's true of everything. You know, you go back, I think she really found her narrative voice in 1934, 1935, when she was reporting on the treatment of the unemployed in the textile towns along the eastern United States. And She didn't hide anything. She always listened and she always looked. And so she ended up writing about child prostitution that was taking place then. She wrote
in the 30s, was it?
Yes, yes.
I'm not surprised that was happening, because you know people see these things and they seem to think that this is just a recent problem, but it's been happening for a long time. I think the thing that surprises me about it was that it was, you know, that it was actually written about, because whenever people will say to me, oh, this is a new thing, I'll say, it's not new. It just hasn't been widely reported on.
That's right. And she ended up making an amalgam of some of the young girls that she met during those months, and included them in a story called Ruby, which was in her collection called The Trouble I've Seen, that was published in early 1936. And it was the book that H.G. Wells found her a publisher for in the UK. And it's the book that Hemingway read. You know, by the time Martha met Ernest at Sloppy Joe's in December 1936, where she was there with her mother, Edna, and her younger brother, Alfred, he knew about her. She'd already published two books. She'd published her novel, What Mad Pursuit, that was published in 1934, and she published The Trouble I've Seen, which was published earlier in 1936. And that book got a lot of attention and fantastic reviews. And Eleanor Roosevelt sent a flare up for it in her My Day column. And that story, Ruby, is a story that Ernest was jealous of. I mean, one of the...
Really?
Oh, yeah. One of the incredible pieces I found in Martha's papers was a letter that Ernest wrote to her dated February 1st. And I knew that to be 1937, although it just says February 1st on it. Now, I couldn't get permission from the Hemingway estate to include that entire letter, but it will be included in the Hemingway Letters Project, which is something I can talk about a little later too. It's just crazy. Anyway, so this letter from Ernest, which, as I said, I think is his first letter to her, it's really about her writing and how much he admires her writing. And he says something along the lines of, you know, if people ask me who my master is, I'm going to have to say Miss Gellhorn, the author of Ruby.
Ooh.
Because he thinks it's the best piece of short fiction he's ever read. And like that in itself is extraordinary, right? Because any of the public information about Ernest has been how egocentric he is, how misogynistic he is.
Who knew he could be so, he could use flattery, you know, so complimentary and humble himself.
Oh, he, you know, absolutely. And it wasn't just about flirting. It was truly about the work. And
yes,
one of the great surprises to me of all of my research was how much I ended up feeling for Ernest. I did not expect that at all. And through their own correspondence with each other, through his correspondence with Edna, Martha's mother, whom he absolutely adored, he showed such a vulnerability about himself emotionally. And that was a great surprise to me. And I wish, you know, with the recent documentary by Ken Burns on PBS, that they had given more time to that aspect of Ernest's character. It seemed to me that they already had decided where the narrative was going. And
that's tough. And especially, you know, I think in these days, and then talking about Martha, who really was a trailblazer for women reporters, and then looking just at Hemingway, whose name comes up in various criticisms of masculinity, it's almost like a disservice to kind of leave that out, because it's like, hey, there's also this that
yeah
realize
Yeah, and they gestured to it a little bit because when they had Patrick, his only living son, who turns 92 next week, when they had Patrick on camera and talking about his dad and talking about his own psychotic break when he was a young teenager and how Ernest slept on his floor with him for the, I think, 5 or 7 weeks, that Patrick was really in a desperate state. And he was such a good father and loved his boys and spent all kinds of time with those boys. And there's lots in the correspondence between Martha and Ernest where she talks about that, what a loving father he is, not just to him, but to her close friends. And Edna, Martha's mother, also acknowledges that about Ernest in her letters to him, which are really extraordinary letters. I mean, long after Martha and Ernest divorced at the end of 1945, Edna and Ernest continued to correspond.
Wow.
And there are beautiful letters from him to her that Martha kept into the early 1950s. So I find that interesting, right? And again, Edna's not even a footnote in the Burns documentary. She's not mentioned at all. And but Burns himself said all biography is failure. So
that's an interesting quote.
Yeah. So I wanted to say something too about some of the other things I found in her papers. I mean, there are lots of unpublished manuscripts, a few of which I quote in the book, just kind of little excerpts from, but there's one that she wrote in the 1980s that she tentatively called Meaningless Question. And I just wanted to quote from it a little piece that I transcribed because it has to do with letter writing. She writes, "Of all her departed friends, she missed the letter writers most. Letters of conversation, for pleasure, hundreds of letters received with delight and answered when she felt like it at equal length." And, you know, that's so true of Martha in her life. You know, she was an inveterate letter writer, for which I am wholly grateful. And I think, you know from dipping into the book that she really wrote as if it was an audience of one, right? Those letters were for the intended recipient, with the exception of some of the letters she wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt, where she's furious about American foreign policy. And they're more like reports, like from Spanish Civil War and from the German Jewish refugee crisis in Prague in spring of 1938. But a lot of her letters to Eleanor are also really intimate letters about each of their lives. And so you see, how their friendship is burnished over the years too.
Yeah, I was reading that she worried that Mrs. R didn't take care of herself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because when Martha lived in the White House, and here's another, plot point that's ridiculous, but she was fired from her job at FIRA because she incited a riot among the unemployed in Idaho when she encouraged the workers to throw a brick through the relief office window at night so nobody would get hurt. And the FBI got word of it and said, "Who is your leader?" And they said, "The relief lady." So she got fired. And the Roosevelts, knowing she couldn't get another job in government, invited her to live in the White House, which is what she did for a few months. And that's where she met H.G. Wells, because he was a guest at the White House. You know, at the time, he was probably the most famous writer in the English-speaking world. And that's where she met him. But she used to help Eleanor answer her correspondence. And they'd be up till 3 o'clock in the morning answering Eleanor's correspondence. And then Eleanor would get up again at 6 or 6:30 and start her day all over again. So Martha knew firsthand how tirelessly Mrs. Roosevelt worked. She was worried for her.
Would it be fair to say that in a way Martha was sort of like her chief of staff?
Probably not, because she actually had a chief of staff.
Okay.
whose name has just, Tommy was her nickname. I'm sorry, it's just gone out of my head. But Tommy was her nickname, and Martha was very close to her as well. When I was cutting from the book before we settled on the final iteration, Malvina Thompson, that's her name.
Okay.
Malvina Thompson. Because there was correspondence with her as well on behalf of Eleanor that sort of added to the narrative, but she got cut as I whittled it down to 528 pages that it ended up being. So, yeah. Martha was very fond of Tommy.
That's pretty incredible as well. I'm sure she has interesting correspondences. Yeah.
And it was sort of like the mechanics of Mrs. Roosevelt's life, right? So there'd be a telegraph wire from Malvina Thompson to Martha saying, Mrs. Zara is going to meet you at the airport. So Eleanor would, you know, when Martha would fly in, she'd be greeted by Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, it's insane. It's insane.
Pretty crazy, but absolutely amazing. First, because I don't want to run too long on time, and I know that people are really going to like this book a lot. So first of all, the audiobook is narrated by Ellen Barkin.
It sure is.
How cool is that?
It's so wonderful, and she is such an extraordinary person. It's just a stroke of good luck how it all happened. You know, when the book was coming out, I reached out to her through Twitter and said, could I have my publisher send her a copy? And I, you know, rambled a little bit about who Martha was. And she wrote back and said, I don't need to know who Martha is. I know who Martha is.
Oh.
And yes, of course you can send the book. So I sent the book.
Great.
And she told me that she would read a few pages every night so she could go to sleep with mine or Martha's words in her head. Well, I mean, how beautiful is that, right? So when it looked like the rights were going to be sold for an audiobook, and by this time I was also writing letters to Ellen, like actual letters. And she was getting to know me and all of that. And so last summer of 2020, I just said, you know, if this happens to happen, how would you feel about being the voice of the book? And in her inimitable way, she said, it would be my fucking honor. So then once a deal was made, we made it contingent on her participation. And then she ended up coming to Toronto in November to shoot a movie. And we met mask to mask one evening and talked all everything. It was just so much fun. But we mostly talked about Martha. And the book was, she recorded the book in April.
Excellent.
Yeah. And the thing is, now that the audiobook is out, I listen to the audiobook every night and just a little bit every night. And it's as if I'm hearing both my words and Martha's words anew. Ellen's performance has brought new meaning to all of those words for me. And I just can't believe how lucky I am that she said yes.
That's awesome. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was, you mentioned something about an Ernest Hemingway project.
Oh, yes. So there is the Hemingway Letters Project. I think they've just completed volume 5. Of an expected maybe 12 or 13. And the managing editor of that is Sandra Stanier. And I got in touch with, I've got other things to tell you too, I just realized. I got in touch with Sandra Stanier, who runs the Hemingway's Letters Project, which, and their purpose is to print every letter of his known in a chronological way with interstitial narrative and footnotes and all of that. So I also happened to get in touch with Valerie Hemingway, who was married to Gregory, Ernest's youngest son. But before she was married to Gregory, she was Ernest's final personal assistant in 1959-1960. She knew Martha. She knew Martha for 25 years. And as it turns out, if it hadn't been for Valerie Hemingway, who went with Mary Welsh, who was Ernest's final wife, to the house in Cuba, to the finca in Cuba after Ernest killed himself, to pull out all of his personal papers, the manuscripts, the correspondence, the letters from Ernest to Martha that exist in his papers, the letters from Martha to Ernest that exist in his papers, would not have made it out of Cuba because Mary Welsh wanted to leave any trace of Martha Gellhorn in Cuba. Valerie just stuffed everything in shopping bags and hauled it out. And she spent 2 years at an office at Scribner's getting the papers all in order that were then donated to the Kennedy Library. And Valerie was the one, sorry, I'm kind of just a little roundabout way. Valerie was the one who said, you must get in touch with Sandy Spanier. Here's her email. So I did, and I said, I found these letters from Ernest to Martha's mother, some letters from Ernest to Martha. I transcribed them. I couldn't use them because of rights reasons with the Hemingway estate. And so now I have, there were letters that they didn't know about. And the Hemingway Letters Project is hugely delighted, especially with the February 1st letter I was telling you about earlier, where he talks about Martha's writing. And so without my research, they wouldn't have these letters for the Hemingway Letters Project. And so I've given them the transcribed letters, and I've written sort of contextual narrative for them when they put the books together. So the books where those letters appear, you know, my name will be part of the contributors to those books. So that's crazy too.
That's so cool. Well, we look forward to all of this.
Martha, in 1966, because she decided to donate her papers to Boston University's Gottlieb archives, she went and she gave a speech there about libraries. And I just wanted to quote a little bit from that speech because it's perfect for a podcast hosted by a library. So she said in 1966, to me, the glory of a library is that it stands as a bulwark against propaganda, against the passing, slanted, expedient doctrine of the day. And they still do, right? That's why libraries matter. They're cornerstones of democracy. You know, public libraries, especially.
Yes, thank you so much. I mean, we certainly hope that others see us as that as well.
Well, libraries are so much more than they used to be. I mean, you're social workers, you're real community hubs, and have been for a very long time. You know, I think of Ray Bradbury, who said libraries raised him, or, you know, Susan Orlean's book, the library book that so extraordinary about the library in Los Angeles, public library in Los Angeles.
Yes, and, yes.
Right? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Libraries, and especially when democracy is under threat, which it is, you know, it continues to be under threat. And libraries matter so much, and public access, and I mean, my book wouldn't exist without libraries, right? I mean, in a very pragmatic way, they wouldn't exist. But I'm a great user of the Toronto Public Library. I'm there weekly picking up books, even throughout COVID, they had curbside pickup.
Yeah.
So, and the library had lineups all through COVID. I mean, we're still shut down here in Toronto.
I have to say, the pandemic was such a ground shift for so many different industries and, worlds. I like to hope that the library world came out of it with, and the world in general came out of it with a better understanding as to how important to the community libraries are. Because I know even buildings that were closed had people working to bring services to people who were in quarantine. Thank you so much. This is great. Yours for probably always, Martha Gellhorn's Letters of Love and War, 1930 through 1949 is it out yet?
It is. So the hardcover is out from Firefly Books, which is here just north of Toronto. And the audiobook is out now from Penguin Random House Audio, read for you by Ellen Barkin. And I'm not saying this because it's my book, but her performance is truly extraordinary. You feel transported to that time. And like Martha, Ellen is a voice for the most disenfranchised. It's not lost on me how similar their temperaments are. And, another reason that I'm grateful to her for standing behind Martha's words. And mine.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Janet Somerville. And we look forward to talking to you again on Turn the Page.
Oh, Jessica, this was just a delight for me. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again. And we are going to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.